Coming up on Tech News Today, what Microsoft announced at the Build Developers Conference. Also, the FTC chides the search engines for their paid placements and Discovery's plan to charge you more. All that more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, June 26th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT6. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Ayaz Akhtar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, put them in context for you, starting each time with the top 10 stories of the day in the news feeds. As Microsoft's Build Developers Conference kicked off this morning, Windows 8.1 preview went live for you to download. You'll need to install an update from the Microsoft website to Windows 8. Then you can find the 8.1 preview in the Microsoft Store after a reboot. You can then install the preview, which is a 2 gigabyte download, and it requires a couple of reboots to install itself. Now, remember, this is a beta version. Be prepared to have to blow out your install if you want to upgrade this to a final build later. So you might not want to put it on every machine you own. Steve Ballmer emphasized that this is the beginning of a rapid release cycle for Windows.
Spanish mobile provider Telefonica says it's sick of iOS and Android having a duopoly in smartphones, so it's backing Windows Phone. Microsoft and Telefonica have signed a one-year enhanced marketing agreement. So if you're in Brazil, Chile, the UK, Spain, Germany, or Mexico, be prepared to have tiles shoved in your face.
Ow! Sounds like it hurts. Sprint announced today that it will offer the HTC 8XT and the Samsung Ative S Neo later this summer. The phones will be the first Windows Phone 8 devices to work on Sprint's unlimited 4G LTE network. The 8XT is $100 on a two-year contract after a rebate, and the Ative S Neo is $149 on a two-year contract, also after a rebate.
Apple has opened up its first online store in Russia. Customers in Moscow and St. Petersburg can order iPhones, iPads, and Macs on Apple's website for the first time. Products were previously only available via third-party resellers. Apple registered apple.rus in August 2012 in prep for the online launch.
It's Apple Rus.
Oh, Apple Rus.
Not daughter, yes. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission wrote to 23 search engines in the U.S. warning them to, quote, clearly and prominently distinguish advertising from natural search results. The letter does not identify any breaches, but states consumers ordinarily expect that natural search results are included and ranked based on relevance to a search query, not based on payment from a third party.
Google issued a new transparency report that said compromised sites distribute more malware than sites designed to be dangerous. Google says there are more than 3,800 dedicated attack sites as of June 9th. However, the number of compromised sites is around 39,000. 60% of those hosted malware, while 40% of those are used for phishing attacks.
Yeah. According to a new report by Strategy Analytics, India has passed Japan to become the third largest smartphone market in the world. China is still number one, followed by the United States. India grew 163% year over year compared to worldwide smartphone growth of 39%. Samsung and Apple lead growth in India, but Micromax, Carbon, and Spice showed 200 to 500% growth. So they're on their tail. IDC put out numbers yesterday showing that the smartphone market in Europe shrunk by shipments 4.2% year over year.
It's turning into a tiny market. The European data protection activists behind Europe versus Facebook campaign group have filed new complaints under regional data protection laws targeting Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Skype, and Yahoo for their alleged collaboration with the NSA's PRISM data collection program. The group argues the companies fall fully under European privacy laws despite being U.S. headquartered companies.
Samsung announced one more version of the Samsung Galaxy S4 because Why not? This one can connect with the LTE Advanced Networks, the real 4G, which can double the speed of current LTE. Almost no country has an LTE Advanced Network yet. Actually, Russian network Yoda is one of the few, Y-O-T-A, not Y-O-D-A. But many carriers have released plans to roll out LTE Advanced within the next couple of years. The phone will come to Korea this summer in blue, Arctic, or red aurora.
July 1st keeps coming, which means Google Reader's death is impending. Today, Dig's replacement for Reader is now rolling out to beta testers. If you haven't signed up, you can at dig.com/reader. Dig Reader for iPad and iPhone will hit the App Store tomorrow.
This episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. Since its platform upgrade last fall, Squarespace has just kept rolling out the new products, the new features, great integrations, making it better all the time. I was able to slap a post up this morning so quickly, it made my brain hurt. It's awesome. Make sure you get the most from these recent innovations. Squarespace has 24/7 support, live chat during the week, extremely fast email support throughout the day and night. Plus, with plans starting as low as $8 a month for software and hosting, this is a real value. You get like high quality, like I'm a huge company with a big data center at my back and a bunch of award-winning designers for $8 a month. It's exceptionally well-designed, fast and easy to use, drag and drop for most of the stuff. That layout engine is amazing and provides a powerful, flexible e-commerce solution. If you want to run a store, you can sell physical and digital goods, sell music CDs and MP3s, whatever you want. Squarespace gives you the best mobile experience, too, making sure your site looks good on any screen. Integrating all your website needs into one platform. Domains, design, development, commerce, hosting, and 24/7 customer support. For a free trial, go to squarespace.com, sign up for a free account. You don't need to give them a credit card or anything. Just try it out. Start building a website. Then, if you decide to purchase it, remember this code, TNT6, because that gets you 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, monthly or annual plans. Now, annual plan, you're going to get 10% off the whole year and a free domain registration when you do that annual plan customer subscription. That's squarespace.com. Use that offer code, TNT6, everything you need to create an exceptional website. And we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. All right, joining us now to discuss the stories of the day, Stuart Miles, founder and CEO of Pocket Lint, back on the show. Good to have you back, Stuart.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us, and we're going to talk about FTC and their letters to the 23 search engines. If you're wondering how many search engines are there out there, AOL counts, Ask, Bing, Blecko, DuckDuckGo, some travel and local search engines as well. And essentially what the FTC is saying is, look, we issued guidelines back in 2002, and we've noticed the compliance starting to decline. In fact, it's an official response, according to Danny Sullivan, to letters that they received from Danny Sullivan of Search Engine Land, plus a letter that came 4 months later from the SEMPO group, another one from a travel industry group. And what they want is to emphasize visual cues and make sure that the text is clear to say whether it's an inline search result or not, this is an ad. Stuart, just on that brief description, do you think this is even necessary? Do you think it's enough? What kind of protections should a government agency be applying to search engines for customers?
I think it's a really difficult one, and it's blending the lines, isn't it, as we sort of look towards what's genuine copy, what's not genuine, whether it's paid for, not paid for. And I know you guys in America are very keen on sort of stressing when things are defined, et cetera, et cetera. I always remember, it makes me laugh when you sort of read the ad, you watch television adverts, and they're like, this drug is going to solve your life. And then at the end, it's like, may cause suicidal tendencies.
Or, may not solve your life.
Yeah, not solve your life in any way, shape, or form. We don't really have the same process here in the UK, so it's sort of difficult. I don't know, it's very much hand-holding. The only thing I can equate it to in the UK is we have a directive that says that I need, as a website owner, I need to tell you when you come to my website that we have cookies. And therefore, now every website in the UK, by law, has to have a pop-up that says, you're about to accept some cookies. We got around it by just saying, click here and we can cookie you. Completely. So now it's just a nuisance. People don't even read how many people read T's and C's on an app or anything? They just, where's the click button and let's get on with it.
Do you think when you're looking at a search engine that it is important for you to know that, there's a different shading for advertisement and there's text that's large and visible to say this was a paid placement or do you care?
I think, sadly, I think a lot of people don't care. I think, obviously, they should. It's nice to know when it's organically, you know, there is a reason for that being there rather than someone paying for it. I think there is an element of people doing that at the moment to some extent. But I think most people don't care. I mean, look, 2012, I think the biggest search term was Facebook.com. That pretty much tells you quite a lot about how people use search engines.
Well, I think sometimes you got to. It's good to have a differentiator on the search results when you are looking up for information, not necessarily looking up websites like Facebook. Because when you're looking up a company and they've paid to have that top spot, that's helpful. But when you're looking for like legitimate, maybe like journalistic content, and you find these are link farms or the people being paid or something like that, it hurts the credibility of the search engines for giving that result if they don't have this little advice saying, "Oh, by the way, they paid us to say this is the best method to save your life."
Yeah, and what's interesting, too, is that Danny Sullivan pointed out that something like Google's shopping search, which is entirely paid, if they follow this by the letter, they'd have to have a visual shading for every search result and a piece of text next to it that was clearly visible in a large enough font size, according to these guidelines, to make sure that everybody knew it was an ad. And the FTC said, well, you know, we're going to be reasonable about this. Like, if the entire thing is paid, you just need to make sure people know that somewhere. But then again, does that mean that, you know, these are just guidelines? I don't know what the stick is here, or actually even what the carrot is here. I guess the stick is the FTC comes in and audits you and makes your life hell and possibly takes you to court for some kind of consumer fraud.
It's one of those things in America. When you go into a store like a Walmart or anything, does it tell you that the promotion at the end of the aisle has been paid for? Because normally that is. So is there a notice from the FTC saying, by the way, we've put this in this store, in this specific place because someone's paid for it? Or is it just obvious? Are we clever enough to know that?
I have to say personally, now, I don't want to come off as against consumer protection. I think it's good to keep an eye on this. I think maybe the FTC is doing the right thing in the end by saying, look, you guys are starting to slip and you're making the text really tiny. Let's be careful about this. But on the other hand, most of the time when I do a search, the top search result isn't the most relevant anyway. So I don't assume when something gets a high placement that that's the best link for me. I usually have to dig down a little bit, sometimes a couple pages. I guess Google didn't used to be like that, but there's just more pages on the web, more people gaming the system with SEO, more spam things showing up in natural search results anyway. I don't know that this really bothers me all that much. But okay, fine. Good for you, FTC. At least
protect us from ourselves, FTC.
Bringing up the conversation, yeah. Let's talk about Google's transparency report. Now, this has usually been used to tell people how many copyright takedown notices they get, how many government requests for information they get. This has actually been in the news quite a bit with the Prism revelations and the NSA. Google is one of the companies saying, we would like to make the FISA court request number, at the very least, part of our transparency report. And that's not what we're talking about right this second. What's going on here is that the Safe Browsing Transparency Report has been added. This takes data from Google's Safe Browsing system. They started that back in 2006. It flags downloads as malicious and also flags certain search results as malicious. And here's what's in this new report. They flag 10,000 sites a day as hacked. Hacked sites actually outnumber malicious sites. 60% of the sites that they flag are hacked. 40% are phishing sites. I'm sorry, 60% are malware. 40% are phishing sites. Malicious sites have declined a bit. Malicious sites are the ones that are created specifically to try to trick you into visiting them and taking advantage of breaching your security. Malicious sites peaked about 6,000 in 2012. They're now 3,891. Hacked sites is taking a site you normally trust, any kind of website out there, a Yahoo or AOL, any kind of website, hacking it, and then delivering the malware, the phishing scheme. So hacked sites, there were 61,571 last July. There were 32,634 at the end of 2012, but that number's edging back up, 39,247 June 9th, 2013. Also, what's changed is the response time used to be 90 days for a website to address the fact that it had been hacked back in May 2009. That fell to 12 days in March of this year, but it's edged back up to 50 days. Now, all of this is very interesting to know, like, okay, we knew there are hack sites out there. We knew there are malicious sites. It's interesting that they're going after hacking existing sites more often than trying to trick people into malicious sites. But, Stuart, what effect will knowing this have on people, do you think?
I think it just means it shows that Google is working to make the web a safer place for people that want it to be safer. You know, none of us want to go to a site where we're suddenly having malware installed and viruses and all the other things, and phishing, data. You know, everybody likes to feel their data is protected. And I think anything that helps us see what Google is doing to solve that, how they're trying to make the web a safer place has got to be a good thing. I think that's useful to know if that's what you really want to know. But it's nice to see how they're doing it and how they're approaching it. And then the great thing is that once they produce these reports, we can then hold them accountable. And so we can say, look, in 2013, you did this. In 2017, you've lost the plot. It's gone up or it's gone down. Or, you know, congratulations, well done. We see it in public life, in government, and all the other stuff, and it's welcomed.
I wonder if this will actually make people change their behavior at all. I mean, that's always the big question. It's really, really difficult to get people to change their security behavior. It's not a bad thing to tell them, hey, there's hacked sites out there. And maybe it will at least raise awareness so people don't make some of the more simple mistakes of saying, oh, well, I'm at a well-known website right now, so I must be able to trust that this form that I'm filling in with my social security number and bank account is going to a trustworthy source. I don't know how much effect that's actually going to have.
I don't know what the report's going to do so much as the browsers that stop you from going to the sites. When you see that giant red page that says, malware detected, do you want to continue? And it explains all that information. I think that's been a greater step to stopping users into falling into these traps. But to actually explain the amount of numbers out there to show that 60% of them have malware and you supposedly trust these places, to have that data out there might give some education. But it's really on the browser side, I think, that actually stops the behavior.
All right, let's talk about starting behavior, the behavior of spending money. Everybody wants to do that. Everybody wants to be the next PayPal, except for mobile. Get you to go out in the world and buy some stuff and use their payment system. Square has been one of the leading ones here. What are they up to now, Ayaz?
They just launched an online marketplace called Square Market. Now, Square's director of discovery, Ajit Varma, said the idea behind the market is to make local businesses accessible to Square users nationwide. And so if you want to create a storefront for Square Market, that's free. You can manage your list items, your inventory. You can put up pictures. That's all free. The Square sites are all very similar with a big splash image on the top. Some of it's a carousel. They move by description of the store underneath. And then everything they sell is in a grid below. And of course, Square's not doing this completely for free. Square gets 2.75% of revenue for each item sold. Now, if you compare that to something like Amazon, Amazon charges 99 cents per item or $40 for bigger sellers. eBay charges vary from free to 30 cents an item, and there's all kinds of charges there. Etsy, another competitor when it comes to storefronts, charges 20 cents per item, but fees apply only when an item is sold or is listed for over 4 months. And then Etsy also has its own transaction fees of 3.5%. Stuart, do you think Square's pricing structure is going to work in the face of the competition out there?
I think it's a no-brainer for Square to try and make people spend more money on Square because obviously they get from the fees in the same way that, you know, PayPal and eBay are joined and Etsy is, you know, very popular. Whether Square have the capabilities to curate a decent store experience and make sense of it, I'm not so sure. I don't know whether my initial thought would be, I'm going to buy something on the internet. Oh, no, I know. Last time I used Square, they told me they had a store and I could go and buy random things. You know, we don't have a Visa store or a MasterCard store where you can just sell random stuff because the popularity of that currency or that way of paying for things is just everywhere. And obviously this is a notion of Square trying to come up with a way of making the brand more memorable. And I don't know whether that's the best way forward.
That's a really good point because this is great for the businesses and for Square, right? As a business, if I'm on Square, let's say I'm a, I don't know, I'm a toy store, and I've implemented Square. I use Square to check people out. I use Square to inventory manage. And Square comes to me and says, hey, guess what? You're already using our payment system. You're already using our inventory system. Check this box and you've got an online store. That's pretty compelling. Suddenly I can sell to the world, right? But Stuart's right. As a consumer, what makes me go to find that store? Etsy has a reputation of having a wide variety of amazing stuff. So people go there. Amazon is the world's biggest store, you know, and people are just in the habit of going there. I'm trying to figure out how Square leads people from the usage of the Square app to pay into looking for things not local. Because when I think of Square, I think, oh, that's that thing where I can open it up and see all the stores around me that geographically where I can go buy stuff. I don't know how I, as a consumer, make that leap to then saying, oh, what about buying things that aren't around me? And that, I guess that's true of any business. Don't get me wrong. Every business has to start somewhere. But it's a different perception from the consumer side.
I'm kind of curious. I just used Square for the first time. A vendor did. They had the Square, and they had to put in my email for a receipt. I'm thinking with those receipts, they could probably promote the Square market a lot more. If they're tracking your spending behaviors, I don't know if they are. I don't know how that's going to work if they're going to target ads. But if you could do that at Square, if they have this marketplace with tons of similar vendors, I could see these email receipts with like, hey, you might also like to check out vendor A, vendor B, because you just spent $300 over at this costume shop or whatever it may be.
Right, right. You were just over at Robinson's Costume and Beauty. So here are some other costume shops with deals, you know.
At Square.
And that's probably it, you know, some kind of discount or something.
It's definitely strange with them. Go, Stuart.
I was going to say, I think if it's as a shopkeeper, if it says that I can create my own store at, you know, teddybearshop.com and it's powered by Square, I think that has some benefit because it makes it easier for me, and that's great. If it's just I'm a teddy bear shop and I'm in the Square Marketplace at squaremarketplace.com, then I see no value in that whatsoever.
Yeah, you've got to make it so it's easy for your customers to find you.
Oh, you have that long list of like it's your.com and it's facebook.com/store, then it's twitter.com/@store, then it's squareup.com/market/. I wonder
There's
if
no
you have
more
to
room
have...
on the pizza box, Ayaz.
We need bigger pizza boxes right now.
And bigger pizzas to follow.
Ooh.
All right, let's talk a little bit about Discovery chairman and founder John Hendricks speaking to Reuters today. He's got a new book out. That's why he's speaking to Reuters. It's called A Curious Discovery. Get it? An entrepreneur's story. In the book, he says, imagine a premium Discovery on-demand streaming video service with easy-to-navigate menus delivered through cable and available only to Discovery's basic cable subscribers. Wouldn't Discovery fans eagerly spend $6 to $8 for that service? Now, when Reuters talked about him, they said they pointed out, hey, this sounds like HBO Go, which you pay for HBO on your cable service, and then you get HBO Go for free. And he said, well, the thing is, we have shows that are 3 to 18 months old. If they're more than 3 months old, they're not likely to be shown on the channel anymore. But they have to be 18 months old before we give them to services like Netflix. So in that window, we make these shows available. And some of our most hardcore fans, say fans of the Science Channel, will pay us a little money to get access to those shows. He also told Reuters, we're about 2 to 5 years away from such a service. Stuart, I have my own opinion of what I think of this strategy. What do you think?
So let me just get this right, because so it's Discovery Channel
right.
offering content they've already filmed or whatever in yeah. between a stopgap while they're waiting to, it's sitting on a shelf somewhere before they can flog it to Netflix or Love Film or anywhere else that wants to take it.
Which is, by the way, their own self-imposed. They decide not to give it to Netflix until 18 months. So from 3 to 18 months, they've got stuff sitting on a shelf. They're going to put it in an app for you. Will you pay for it?
So somewhere there's an accountant, a bean counter in there going, we could squeeze a little bit extra cash out of this content and it's not going to really cost us anything apart from creating a downloadable service or a streaming service. Yeah, I think they're going to do that. That makes sense.
Would you buy it, though? When you look at all of these apps out there, like the BBC iPlayer and ABC.com and Hulu and Love Film, are you going to say, yes, I will pay extra. And here's the key. I skipped this part. I apologize. You have to be a current cable subscriber who receives the Discovery Channel in order to have the privilege of giving them $6 to $8 extra.
No, I think that starts to stretch it a bit more, unless you're treating it like an archive and then you're going to sell it to schools or universities, right? Because there's a factual basis to it. And then that's a completely different market of people. And then you'd be better off saying, look, you have all of this content. We're not going to charge you $6 to $8. We're going to charge you $1,000 a month for the entire university to access this content, because there's a wealth of content and that's amazing to you as part of a research package. I think that's probably a better solution than randomly picking up an extra, you know, couple of hundred people paying six bucks because they have a real fetish for Shark Attack versus giant squid.
Well, I here's the thing. I guess I could sort of see it if it was independent of the you have to receive the channel restriction. But they're trying to play it both ways. They're trying not to upset their cable partners and saying, oh, we won't sell this to anybody who doesn't already pay you guys. But then that means I'm having to pay twice. Like, I already get your channel. I've got a DVR. I can record all the Shark Week I want. Why am I also going to have to pay? HBO says, hey, if you pay for the cable service we provide through your cable company, we'll give you HBO Go as a part of that service if the cable company agrees.
It's almost like a magazine or a newspaper saying, you might have to pay for our iPad app or get through our paywall to access the stuff on the web. You know, it's a tough one. Some people are happy to do that. Some people think that that's an outrage.
Well, it's similar to the way movies are sent out. There's a ridiculous self-imposed windows when it comes to movie releases. You'll get them at home. If you want it on DVD, you have to wait a certain amount of time. If you want it on Blu-ray, you wait a certain amount of time. If you want it on VOD, you wait a certain amount of time. If you want it in a hotel, you get it earlier for some reason. If you want it on HBO, like this windowing thing is really old when it comes to movies. I'm just wondering if Discovery's like, hey, wait a second. Like Stuart was saying, there's this little extra window where we can make a little bit more money,
and totally
it works for movies.
Yeah.
Why would people not accept this? Because we'll just make it easier. Because like Tom, like you're saying, you can put it on your DVR, but it takes effort to get it from your DVR to your portable device because of all the restrictions that have been made on these tablets and phones that we just didn't accept with PCs. For some reason, we're all like, yeah, sure, you can lock down everything you want with tablets and phones, but this kind of thing is just going to make Discovery lots of money.
I don't think it's going to, though. I think that's definitely Stuart's right. That's what they're thinking. But when you start to think about it, the crowd dwindles, right? It's the crowd that loves Discovery. And the crowd that loves Discovery enough that they'll watch older stuff that maybe they missed or want to watch again. And then it's the crowd that will watch the stuff that they missed or watch again that is in the 3 to 18 month ratio. They're not going to get upset that like, hey, I'm paying for this and suddenly it disappeared because now it's on Netflix. And it's the crowd that's already paying for cable and doesn't want to be a cord cutter. I just think that crowd is too small. You've got to just make this available, maybe with advertising, as an extra bonus in addition to the cable subscription, or as something you can pay for whether you have the cable subscription or not, just as an archive. Because even the New York Times or the London Times, any times, with their paywall, offer you more than one way to pay to get at their stuff. They don't say, well, you have to pay this much to get at anything and then pay an extra stuff to get at the, you know, it's just doesn't make sense to me.
You could get away with just saying it's $6 to watch an episode.
Yeah.
Because the people that want to, if you're researching something about giant sharks or some science program about Mars or something like that, chances are you're happy to pay $6 to specifically watch that program because you feel that it's going to give you enough information that justifies the $6 or $5 or $10 or whatever it is. You're not going to think, you know what, I'm going to watch this every month because I know that there's a huge series on Mars that I missed 3 months ago that now I can start watching again, because it's the window of opportunities. Nobody's going to be talking about it 3 months time because you're there for a specific purpose because you've heard about something.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you can do, I mean, Discovery does sell some of their shows through Vudu or iTunes services like that, I believe. So they, you can already do that. I'm a little befuddled by the optimism of Mr. Hendricks, but we'll see. Meanwhile, Microsoft Build going on right now. We talked a little bit in the news fuse about it. Iaz gave us a little bit of update earlier on. And what else have they been talking about that we haven't talked about yet, Iaz, as they go along in Moscone Center in San Francisco?
Okay, apart from the news fuse items, there are big applications coming to Windows 8. You're going to see Flipboard, Facebook, and NFL is bringing its content and applications to Microsoft devices, including the Windows tablets and PCs. There was all kinds of demos of Windows 8. They did show off the refined experience, as they called it. Julie Larson Green was up there giving demos. And there's news that Windows 8.1 will support high-res displays. So if you've ever tried a Windows 8 device on one of these crazy displays that are going out there now, you know that the UI elements are really tiny. Now they will scale. So they actually have good touchable elements when it comes to that. This one's kind of a sleeper. An Office Alpha demo showing touch support. Now, Larson Green showed off PowerPoint running on Windows RT. That's right, Windows RT is still not dead. And this was a PowerPoint optimized for touch. They said it's an alpha. This is the first time they're showing it to anybody. And then when there was a hardware demo, they actually showed off more Windows RT devices. Looks like Microsoft's still backing that. Then they brought out a MakerBot 3D printer. Windows 8.1 will support 3D printing. They told developers that with 8.1, you can create an app that lets you manipulate and create 3D objects. They showed off some Lego robots using Windows 8, so some cool Maker stuff. And obviously, this is a developers conference, so they want you to make apps for this. Every developer gets a free Surface Pro today. So if you're out there at Build, you're getting a Intel
powered. They got an Acer too, right? Like an Iconia or something?
I don't know if they got the Iconia.
Yeah, the Iconia W3.
Oh, they got the W3.
And a Surface Pro, yeah. So
they're making out like bandits over there at Build. There was a Bing demo sample app showing off a lot more voice power that you'll be able to trigger events on a Windows Phone device by speaking to it a lot more. Those are the major things that have been going on since the news fuse.
So rapid release was the big thing that Ballmer mentioned. They talked about a lot about phones. They talked a lot about device transformation, smaller tablets, the touch stuff you're talking about with Office. They're talking about the apps plan. Did you find out what the new Windows experience? They're saying one experience on every device for everything in your life. Ballmer made a big coffee metaphor at the beginning of this thing about how they're refining the blend.
From what I can tell, it's just the tiles. Like they just like in their video, the Windows Everywhere ad, they're showing an image of a Surface device, a Lenovo device, and a Windows Phone, and they just have their start screens up of tiles. So the thing that Ballmer said early on said, should we call it a PC? Talking about Transformers devices, should we call it a tablet? What I call it is Windows all the time. So it seems like they're just talking about the unified interface more than anything else.
And as Stuart mentioned, there's early access to Kinect for Windows. Program costs $399, but you'll be able to get a Kinect device to put into the Windows. And that Office is not coming until 2014. Is that right?
Yeah, because the version they showed us today was the alpha. So they did not say, at least as far as I've seen, I don't know about 2014 being the release date. But that seems to be in line with the rapid release cycle that Ballmer was talking about.
All right, Stuart, in this cavalcade of announcements from Microsoft, anything turn your head, get you excited?
There seems to be a lot of tiles, almost like more tiles than my bathroom. So that was an obvious gag to play. I think the Kinect stuff is fascinating. And, you know, I was lucky enough early in the year to go to the Microsoft Envisioning Center where they're sort of using, they sort of look, you know, those videos where there's people playing, you think sort of 10, 15 years out, and you think this is just bonkers. Well, they're actually building a lot of that stuff in the Envisioning Center already, like see-through computers, and things like that. And so I think the Kinect stuff will help that massively. And I suspect that they will try and roll that out as much and, you know, as far and as wide as they possibly can. And, you know, the conference Build is a developer conference. That's what it's all about. It's all about the geekiness and not necessarily, you know, dealing with us consumers, but just empowering the developers to come up with cool and exciting things. And any tool that allows them to do that is going to be welcomed. I'm surprised, rather than just chucking them a Pro and a W3, they're not saying, you know, have the Kinect sensor as well and just really go for it.
Yeah, I guess they just don't have it yet, huh?
Well, also, Bing was opened up for developers as well. So if developers want to use the power of Bing in their apps, they can. They showed off some 3D imagery in their maps, in Bing Maps. So you'll be able to take those 3D images and put them in your applications right away. They're spending a lot of time talking about how Bing is built into Xbox and how it powers Apple Siri and all of these different things out there. So they're betting big on Bing.
So the getting back to the Kinect, I was talking, dug up the details here. Mm-hmm. It's the new Kinect, 1080p HD depth camera, 30 frames per second RGB color video. And if you want to be a developer who gets access to this, because this is a developer thing, and I think that's smart, because one of the first things people did when the first Kinect came out was start hacking it like crazy. And one of the smartest things Microsoft did was pull back from trying to stop them. That was their first impulse. And then they said, well, wait a minute, let's actually work with developers. So now they're doing it for sure. Applications for Kinect for Windows Developer Kit program must be submitted by July 31st. You'll be notified in August if your application was accepted, and then you'll receive the following items in November: direct access to the Kinect for Windows engineering team by a private forum and some webcast, early SDK access, private access to the API and sample docs, a pre-release alpha sensor, and that may be why they didn't give one to them today, as they don't have it ready yet, and a final release sensor at launch. But you still have to pay $399 for it, right? Even though you're paying, that's kind of the new thing. You have to pay for Google Glass if you want to be a developer that takes advantage of it, because it's the hot new thing. Stuart, does that work for Microsoft to say, yeah, this is hot, this is hot, you want to develop it for Windows, pay for it?
I think it cuts the wheat from the chaff. It means that you're only going to get serious applicants. If otherwise, we'd all be inundating them with, like, yeah, I want to do that, sounds fun, you know, and then get it and think, actually, no. But if you've got to pay $400... or, you know, $1,500 for Google Glass, you've got to seriously think about whether you're going to spend time to develop this thing. And then once you've bought it, you're invested. You think, I've spent $1,500 on this. I've got to buy something. I've got to do something with it. And so I think it not only empowers you, but it's that justification to yourself that you need to do something with this. You need to, you know, make sure that you fulfill your promise because you've invested money. And the more money you invest, the more you justify it to yourself that you've got to do it.
And Microsoft's currently showing off Project Spark. They said in less than 5 minutes, we'll build a game from scratch via Smart Glass on the Xbox One.
Oh, that's cool.
And you can build a game for Xbox One, 360, and Windows 8. It'll be available on Xbox One, Xbox 360, and Windows 8. Play the way you want on whichever platform. So it lets you build your own world in game. So they're doing this very quickly, showing you what you can do. They said it's an application that lets you make applications.
This was pretty interesting when they announced it at E3, but they didn't go into a lot of details, which I guess makes sense. That was for the gaming industry, not for the developers per se. So this is the right place to go with it. I'm curious, though, if we're going to hear them change their tune on publication of indie games, right? This is great. Make it easy for the developers to make a game. But right now, if you want to get into the indie store on Xbox, you got to have a publisher accept your game. And that's making a lot of independent game developers chafe. I'm not sure how many people are going to use Spark if they're like, oh, but then I have to sell it to somebody.
Well, if Spark is out there and you can maybe sell your own worlds within Spark, so I guess Microsoft would be the publisher, because that was Microsoft's hang-up, right? It was you need to have a publisher. So if they create their own indie brand, as it were.
We're the publisher, yeah.
Yeah, if they create
Microsoft
that.
Microsoft is a publisher, that's true.
They could probably get away with that. So I don't know if they will have the same kind of open system that Sony has, but I could see Microsoft doing that. This is our indie section.
Yeah,
from us.
But if you think about it, it's the same that Apple do already with the App Store. You know, you have a game, you create the game, you still have to submit it to them. They host it, they make sure it works, they approve it, and everybody then buys it, and then they take a cut for doing all that. So I think the thing with me, and I was at E3 and at WWDC, you know, 2 weeks ago. The thing is that if you look at the major consoles, the Microsoft, you know, the Xbox One and the PS4, they're all about big adrenaline games. They're about big publishers spending big amounts of money to really give you a big bang of, you know, shock on your screen. There's no dev stuff. There's no indie stuff, really. There's no sense of the three of us could suddenly start building something and making it happen and then put it into the App Store and becoming a huge success. This, to me, Project Spark sort of tries to start to address that. I think it's a huge play for Microsoft and has the potential to be massively successful, because it's the fact that the three of us could create something.
Sure.
Submit it and then become the next Angry Birds, become the next Rovio, and all of a sudden everybody's buying an Xbox One because of that reason. And that's, to me, is great. That's really empowering.
All right. Well, the event is still going on, so we'll keep an eye on it. If anything big gets announced, and of course, we'll wrap up stuff tomorrow on the show as well. But for now, let's move on to the randomizer. Because mad scientists, at least Engadget calls them mad scientists, are turning roaches into cyborgs and controlling them with the Kinect. Here's your developers at work right now. Putting circuits on roaches and then using the Kinect to send commands to those circuits that tap into the brain of the roach so that you can guide them and see what they see. Dr. Albert Bozkurt of NC State University said, our goal is to be able to guide these roaches as efficiently as possible, and our work with Kinect is helping us do that. And the point is to explore and map disaster sites, or at least that's what they say. Do you trust them? Or the roaches coming for you next?
I always trust roaches.
Roaches check in, and then you use Kinect to guide them back up.
It's like you, scientists have created a way to make you appear to bring a plague. And it's like, oh, I will bring cockroaches to Jason's house. Don't piss me off.
Thanks.
It's the opposite, though. They're gonna go into disaster sites and find you, because that's what I want to see.
That's after.
If I'm stuck in the rubble, is a horde of roaches stamping.
Yeah, right.
This is the scene from Fifth Element, though.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. This is when Gary Oldman sends the little cockroach in to listen to what they're doing with the president, and he bashes it. He squashes it dead with his shoe. Someone's obviously watched Fifth Element, loves it so much, thought, that is the best idea in the world. I'm going to make it a reality. That's it. I'm going to dedicate my life to making that real.
Dr. Alper Bozkurt of North Carolina State University, are you a big Fifth Element fan? We'll dig into that and find out. Let's see what's on the calendar. Amazon will sell its Kindle tablets and e-readers online in India starting tomorrow. Also tomorrow, BlackBerry Messenger and the whole BlackBerry app coming to iOS and Android. NVIDIA's Shield launches, and Sony says it will put out that patch to fix the PlayStation 3 that was bricked. Samsung Galaxy S4 Mini gets a July 1st release date at Phones for You. It will cost more than a GS3. And Nokia will stream its July 11th New York Lumia event. And we know it's going to be a Lumia with a 41-megapixel camera, but they're still teasing it as 41 million reasons to tune in. But you'll be able to watch it live as Nokia's going to stream it. So good on you, Nokia. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
First, a message from me. I think BBM's rumored date was tomorrow, but that, I think, was denied by BlackBerry. But now we got a message from Mr. Glass saying, hey, TNT crew, just wanted to send you a little note that while many of the technical projects on Kickstarter are failing to deliver on time, some companies are going out of their way to make sure backers get treated as VIPs. Dungeon Roll, a campaign I backed months ago, had some delays that put part of their production run past their timeline. They still had enough units to ship to backers, but they would not have enough units for their planned launch at Gen Con. People, including backers, responded to this, saying that they should delay shipping to backers so that it could be sold at Gen Con. The creators responded with a new update the next day, stating in no uncertain terms that, quote, games will be shipped to backers prior to selling additional games anywhere. So this is obviously in relation to the whole Ouya mess yesterday.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I actually got into a couple of arguments with people who were like, Kickstarter is a store. I'm like, well, you want it to be a store, and maybe Kickstarter should change their mind and make it a store, but that's not the idea, and I kind of don't think it should be. I think they should fight against that, because the idea of Kickstarter is you're backing something to make it possible.
Yeah, the companies that go onto Kickstarter that have to back up what they're saying. They're saying we're going to get it to a developer, get it to you guys first as a backer, and then they don't do that as Ouya did. That hurts Ouya more than anything else, and that makes their word mean a lot less.
All right, well, that ends up our show today. Thanks, everybody, for watching or listening. And, Stuart, always great to have you along. Thank you for joining us today. Let folks know what you're up to. What's going on over there at Pocketland?
Taking down the usual stuff on tech news, tech reviews, features, exciting stuff, everything about Build. Currently, the guys have been writing away. As usual stuff, just trying to bring you an interesting insight into the wonderful world of tech from a UK but global perspective.
Excellent. And an excellent site, pocket-lint.com. technewstoday.com. Go check it out. Also, check out our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. That is the place where you can go to let us know what stories you'd like us to cover. Vote them up, vote them down. Make your voice heard at technewstoday.reddit.com. That's it for us. You can find us on the web, twit.tv/TNT. Email us, tnt@twit.tv, or give us a call. Leave us a voicemail, 260-TNT-SHOW. We'll be back tomorrow with Steve Kovac. See you then.